Okay, good morning, class. I'm Captain Bill Lauro, as before, and hopefully I will be tomorrow, too. So, we're going to continue on the resistive training. Now, let's get a hand of everybody that does resistive training in the classroom, okay? Everybody that's currently and consistently doing a resistive training program, okay? So, I would hope and pray that as you guys move through this course, that you would understand the benefit, the true benefit of the rationale of doing a resistance training program consistently, where you're at least challenging your body in that way, in that capacity, at least 2 days a week. If you're not, you're going to set yourself up for habitual problems that may plague you for the rest of your life. And it's our job, as owners of exercise, to set the example, okay? So there's nothing more disheartening than going into a PT clinic and having someone show you what you need to do that very obviously has no concept of that personal habit. Okay? So don't go get a haircut from a barber with really bad hair. Okay? And if you see that physical therapist or that technician that aren't applying those things to their everyday life, just beware. I'm not saying they don't know their stuff, but practice, right? And these terms and these things, and I'm not judging anybody, but the switch has to go off as far as ownership. And ownership comes through doing and repeating and practice. And a lot of the stuff, it has very, very good gym application, fitness application, and clinical application. Okay? So, let's get away from the slide count because I'm not very popular right now. So, elements of a resistance training program. Things that we're going to just talk about quickly. Type, alignment, stabilization, and dosage considerations. Frequency, intensity, volume, speed, duration. Type, mode of exercise. Type of exercise chosen is based on several factors. What type of muscle action? What do we want to do? Do we want a static or dynamic versus an isokinetic? Form of resistance. Is it going to be manual, mechanical, constant, or variable? Body position. Is it weight-bearing or non-weight-bearing? Supine versus standing. And range of motion. Short versus full arc motions. You kind of have a very, very good idea about all these components very quickly when you size up the patient that you're dealing with, all right? These things will jump at you very fast once you know them, all right? Like if I get a patient with a really, really bad postoperative knee, I already know what I'm going to do with them in these components and types of exercise. Alignment, what are we trying to do as far as aligning those body segments to optimize the muscle action during strengthening? Alignment with respect to gravity and alignment based on muscle fiber direction. So this is a good example. I like to think of alignment based on functional components of things like throwing, kicking, jumping. If I'm working with a thrower and I'm doing resistive training with them, I'm going to have them throw in their throwing motion or their diagonal as opposed to always just working in single line planes, okay? If I'm trying to get someone to increase their push-up score, you think I'm going to waste my time doing a whole bunch of chest flies with them? No. I'm going to align those muscle fibers consistent with a pushing motion, all right? Stabilization, holding down a body segment or holding the body segment. This has a lot to do with our core. And make no mistake, our core is 360 degrees around from your sternum down to your pubic area, but it's firing all the time, okay? So we do the core strengthening all the time in the clinic, but stabilizing that area and those muscle groups, it's not as easy as you might think, okay? Because we've been trained to do them so differently over a long period of time. But maintaining alignment with stabilization, it really helps you avoid those substitute motions that are really, really consistent with form fatigue. And a good example is a person that's doing maybe an overhead press, okay? Maybe the weight's not real heavy, and they're standing, they're not seated, they're standing, they're doing that overhead press, maybe they're using 50 pounds, and they're on number 5, and they have to start arching, okay? Start arching. They start arching their back and really using kind of things that are consistent with form fatigue and potential injury. But it's not because their shoulders are weak. It's because their core strength isn't where it needs to be for that activity. Okay? So a lot of the stabilization things, you have to understand that our spine is a spinal engine and everything starts and ends here. And we have these big, strong arms and legs, and oftentimes they overpower the core, and then the activity as a whole becomes very inefficient. Okay? So we use stabilization techniques in the clinic a lot so we can get the most out of our arms and legs. All right? I love stabilization activities. So there's external applied manually by technician, and there's internal, your isometric contractions that you use to hold things down. Frequency, number of exercises per session, number of exercise sessions per day or week. Okay, when we say frequency, how frequently you're doing it today, how many times you're doing it this week. All right, and that's dependent on your intensity, your volume, your patient goals, your patient status. Decrease frequency when greater intensity. This is important. Does anybody know the term of periodization, or how you period up and period down? This is really, really important with elite-level athletes, that we adjust their frequency and their volume based on where they are in the season. Okay, but volume comes by a couple different things. If you're doing a lot of weights, like real heavy weight, we wouldn't do as many repetitions, right? We wouldn't do it as many times. If I'm in the off season, I'm trying to get my volume really high, like to train and get my muscles where they need to be. But as my season comes on board, I don't want to train as high because it might affect my performance, okay? So we're always adjusting these things for the most important component of exercising, where your exercises don't mean anything if you're not giving your body the opportunity to recover. And if you do it right, your muscles grow and your metabolism keep going during your off-training time. And we always want to avoid this overtraining. Overtraining results in declining performance due to excessive frequency, inadequate rest, and progressive fatigue. And overtraining is very, very easy to spot because performance goes down, pain goes up. In the clinic, it's very clear when overtraining's there. In a collegiate setting or like an exercise elite level setting, overtraining is consistent with chronic depression, believe it or not. You get these athletes, these really high-end athletes, and they're moody, and they come in and they're just not acting like themselves, and they're like clinically depressed, and oftentimes they're overtraining. And what we have to do is we have to pull them off the block, increase their carbohydrates significantly, and give them some rest, and then their mood and their recovery changes. So, but overtraining is very easy to do, because when we see results from good exercise, what do? Keep doing it. More is better. Mo is better. Mo better, right? Mo better. Not always. We don't want it. There's that fine line, that optimal training zone, right? So amount of resistance, intensity is the amount, the weight, and how much, it's your training load, all right? Intensity is really hard to adjust appropriately and make it right, and it comes through time, and oftentimes clinically, you'd like to think it's a sweet science in the clinic, but oftentimes we adjust our intensity when we know we're not doing enough for the patient or when we start to see things of overload, okay, or overtraining. Yes, please. That's a great question. Did everybody hear that question? Can you go back or kind of revert back to something easier or not as taxing? Definitively, yes. Okay? Definitely. And it's really going to be your job as a physical therapy technician to make that decision. If I'm evaluating a patient and you come into my office to tell me that you're going to ramp somebody down because they're in pain, there's going to be the no-dull factor. Okay? But you guys are going to have the knowledge, the skills, and the training to be able to do just that. It's really your job to see, are we at overload? Overload, as you see, the principle is key. To improve muscle performance, muscle must be loaded beyond normal limits. Okay? So if we want to get those muscles, just like when we were stretching, remember we talked about micro failure yesterday? We want those muscles to rip a little bit, tear and break down, so when they're resting, they can recover and adapt and become bigger. Okay? So we need overload, but don't confuse overload with overtraining. Okay? Because overtraining is to the decrement of the patient or the athlete. All right? Oftentimes, I use the term athlete, and it's for two reasons. Because our soldiers, our sailors, our coasties, they're like tactical athletes, you know, in all forms. But I'm a sports medicine guy. I'm a sports physical therapist, so I attribute what we do with soldiers, sailors, Marines, and Coasties as sports medicine on the battlefield. So if you hear me say athlete, just think of the types of folks we're seeing in the clinic. Huge sports medicine model in the military, right? So overload principle. Just know, you're not going to increase things unless you put that muscle to its end and just a little beyond, right? You have to give it more than just what it's used to doing, because if we give that old frail woman the same activities that she's used to doing around the house, she's not going to change, right? So overload is key. I think there's kind of a no-doll factor here, okay? Factors affecting training load. Yes, as the patient age, health and fitness level degrade or increase, we can change. The diagnosis, a sprained ankle is very different from someone that has, an ACL tear. So the extent of injury or impairments, how much range of motion, how much strength they have, the stage of tissue healing, if you're not in tune with that by after yesterday's lecture, then we probably need to revert. But and patient goals and expected outcomes. And do we want to give submaximal or maximal exercise loads? So there is definitely an intent to having submaximal intensity. Moderate to low intensity loads, moderate and low intensity loads are used when we're beginning an exercise program to assess the patient's response. Do we want to take that patient that's in a lot of pain and discomfort and give them a max exercise load? No. Do no harm, right? So we're probably giving them the lower level exercise, and I'd rather have them come in and tell me, no, sir, ma'am, this is much too easy for me, and then we could adjust fire as opposed to coming in and having the decrement of form fatigue, right? Early stage of tissue healing, obviously, after periods of mobilization, when we know those folks are typically coming from a weak environment because they've been degraded through immobilization. Children or older adults, why is that important? That we use submaximal loads for children and older adults. Please.
Their muscles are still growing.
Okay.
Still in development.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that definitely has something to do with it. So there's kind of a muscularity component to that. We know as we age, those muscles, they don't need to be maximally taxed to the point of ripping and tearing. And just like you said, you know, these particularly prepubescent children, you know, their muscles are growing. With children, we're really concerned about the epiphyseal plates, the growth plates. So it's typically with a submaximal load. See, Leopard, you're all over it, brother. So I'm just trying to kind of fluff him up a little bit because he's really mad about the test from yesterday. He's coming around. But listen, a maximal load can often be uncontrolled. Okay, what happens when you don't have that person that really knows what they're doing, training a young 13-year-old kid that still has epiphyseal plates, this overzealous father that's throwing the same amount of weight that he thinks he should have been able to do when he was that age, when in reality the dad's got a 4-pack-a-day habit and... No, I'm okay. But you don't want to overload with maximal weight where there's an uncontrolled motion that could potentially compromise those epiphyseal plates. That epiphyseal plate's compromised, then you have a growth problem, and oftentimes it's not the problem that the epiphyseal plate's broken, but the other arm and leg continue to grow, and then you have leg length discrepancies and stuff. And then for the older folks, you guys are right on, but then you have more problems with bone density things. You know, why would you want to put a submaximal squat on a woman with osteoporotic hips that potentially compromise her femoral neck? You know, so, and unfortunately, and not all elderly, and we say that with a lot of respect, but some, but I don't want to say all children, they don't really always have the mentation to appreciate what we're trying to do with weight training, and they do something that's not consistent with safety. All right? It's really important. You know, when I hesitate and slow down the slide count, it's for life lessons there. Okay, so improving muscle endurance, yes. So we're not going to put a maximal load on the bar when we're trying to increase endurance. If we want to increase muscular endurance, we need to do a lot of repetitions over time, right? So we probably want to stick around maybe that 15 to 30 or more, as opposed maximal strength gains, you're looking at 1 to 3 repetitions, 5 to 8 repetitions. But for muscular endurance, we're looking far beyond that, maybe 15, 25, and beyond, right? So submaximal, I think the big problem that we see in the gym settings, the fitness settings, that particularly the overzealous men that are kind of mirror jockeys and just trying to get huge, they don't believe in submaximal exercise, when indeed it could help them quite a bit, all right? So submaximal, particularly as you age, is really great. You can get a lot of good training effect, particularly if you're looking at the aesthetics of what you want to look like. If you want to look really good, oftentimes submaximal loads will set you free. Maximal exercise loads. For intensity, that's really good when we're really trying to address strength, power, and size. Definitely the later stage of rehab, right? We can start loading up the plates a little bit in that the remodeling phase, the maturation phase. Conditioning programs with no tissue pathology and competitive athletes. Those are the folks that you start to see kind of higher end maximal loading. And it comes in all form. How much resistance should I apply? All right. I always like to see that shuffle in a seat when you see a bolded item. Mm-hmm. So it's so powerful. So powerful. Not to be confused with muscle power. So what's RM? This is a big term that you see in the medical literature. Repetition maximum. Let's probably pay attention more to that lower definition. The one up top is good because you can put it in context, but I like that lower definition for all reasons. And who knows, you might see it not on just one test, but another test you'd have to take twice. the anger, you know? You know what, if it makes you feel any better, I don't have to take that test again. Okay. Now, oftentimes, there will be times that you will realize that it's good to be me, Captain Bill Laura. Okay? And this is one of them. But the maximal number of times an individual can move a load with proper form and technique before fatiguing. Okay? So, if I pick up 35 pounds and I bench press it, my RM might be like 50 for that. Whereas, if I put 185 pounds on, it might just be 3. All right, so your RM can change based on your load. So if someone says, well, what's his RM? You know what? If he says, what's his 1 RM? All right, I'd be like, okay, I know I could probably bench press this much weight without form fatigue. That's my 1 RM. All right. Can you help your battle buddy there? We're covering some testable things. Yeah, I don't want you to miss the test stuff, okay? So, and that'll be one of those opportunities where the human condition will kick in. And that's okay, but we're setting you guys up for success, right? Well, yes, please.
I'm sorry, can you 1 RM?
Okay, so this is a big term that physicians will use. They're like, all right, I want you to work this person out to their 10 RM. It'll be your job to find out how many times they can move a weight just 10 times, not 11, not 12, but just 10 times without form fatigue. So if we ask Mr. Manny Goats, roughly, what's your 1 RM for a bench press? Do you have any idea? So how many times could you bench press the most amount of weight one time? Or I shouldn't say how many times, but how much weight can you max? That's a 1 RM, all right? So you don't have to answer because we know it's a sick amount of weight. We know you're country strong, you know? You guys ever hear that term, country strong? If you ever see country strong guys mad, go to a different zip code. That's all I can tell you, okay? So, all right? So, what's your max? That's another term. What's your 1 RM? Okay? So, the maximum number of times an individual can move a load. So, it could be 10 RM. It could be 15 RM. I could say, what's your MR, your RM for 35 pounds on a bench press? Okay? So,
all right. It'll always be the number of times you can do a certain amount of weight.
Yep.
But it won't be like 50 for...
No.
It won't be the amount of weight. It'll always be the number of times.
You're kind of delineating your RM to what you can do, just like this says, the number of times you can move that load. So it could be load specific. So for a bench press of 50 pounds, your RM may be very different from Mr. Zimmer's. Looking at you, I'm thinking it's probably the same, though. No, I'm only kidding. I'm only kidding, Zimmer. Come on, there's a lot of love there. This guy hooks me up with more candy than anybody. Okay, cool. Okay, standard weight determination methods. We often use the 1 RM method. Not so much because, can you imagine using a a 1 RM in an injured person that potentially could get hurt. Okay, so oftentimes that's trial and error, and it's better to underestimate for obvious reasons, right? So if you're feeling really heroic that day, you could still get injured. So strength training zone exercise is based on a percentage of the RM. So low loads, we typically look at about 30 to 40% of our 1 RM. And high loads, we typically look at about 90 to 100% of our 1 RM, right? It's really neat. A lot of times you can see in a very well-trained person, they might only be able to do a weight one time, but if they bring it down 90%, their repetitions can go up significantly. Yeah, so volume. This is something you should probably know. Volume is consistent on the number of repetitions and the number of sets. Now, as the repetitions go up, right, the volume goes up. As the number of sets go up, the volume goes up. All right? So higher loads result in lower volume, where lower loads result in higher volume. Now, what does that mean? If your repetitions, and you look at your sets and repetitions, let's say we're going to do 3 to 5 sets. Let's just say we're going to go into the gym and do 3 sets of bench press. All right? So all things being said, I'm going to do 3 sets. Is everybody familiar with that term, 3 sets? That means I'm going to try it, do as many as I can, put it down, rest my 60 seconds to 3 minutes, and do it that set 2 more times. Does anybody have any question what a set is? Now, I'm not ready to make guarantees yet, but we're gonna have some competitions in this class. But I'm going to throw out some very, very straightforward terms, and everybody's going to say that they're definitively clear on them. And I will bet 1 or 2 people will get those terms wrong on the test. And I've never lost a bet. And the bet is typically physically oriented. Either I'm going to do push-ups to the humiliation of my rank in front of you guys, or you guys get to do my push-up routine. So, and I'm not ready to make that bet, but someone will probably get sets wrong on the test. So, if I have a heavy weight, okay, if I have a heavy weight, a real heavy weight, my number of repetitions is going to go down. All right. Now, if I have a lower load, my number of repetitions can go up. Okay? So you could see an increase or a decrease in your volume, believe it or not, because your volume is also still weight-dependent. But when it comes to the number of sets, the number of repetitions, it's straightforward, kind of a no-duh factor. If you have a low load, you're going to do a lot of repetitions, right? And there's an intent for that, just like if you have a real high load where you can only do it 5 to 8 times, your repetition is going to go down, okay? And believe it or not, there are some folks that say they understand that concept and they may get that wrong on an exam. Okay, so repetitions, the number of times an exercise is done, usually set range is to achieve up to about 8 to 12. That's typically a trainable range that we're given the clinic. And it's referred to as your RM zone, 8 RM versus 12 RM, your repetitions max, right? Depends on the patient status and training goals. A lot of times I'll ask a patient to do something 35 times, whereas sometimes I only have them do it like 5 to 8. Sets, predetermined number of repetitions grouped together. A single set early in rehab for resistance training versus multiple sets used in later phases. I always like to see people do 1 to 2 sets, see how their body responds. If they get increased pain or discomfort, then we're probably going to keep it consistent or maybe lower it. But if they're doing great, we're going to probably move them that 3 to 5 sets, right? Pretty straightforward. Speed of muscle contraction affects muscle tension. We already talked about that. Force velocity curve. I don't want you to get wrapped up on that too much, but as velocity increases, force decreases. For a concentric muscle activity, this is right there with what we talked about, those push-ups. Remember, we do it really, really fast, and we don't have to spend as much muscle force, and we won't get fatigued as quick. That's why we want to keep the best form that we possibly can during our push-ups, during the APFT, just do them really, really fast, right? As fast as you can. So, but for trainable effects that are safe and allow better control and create those micro failures that we want about 5 seconds per repetition, believe it or not. The golden standard is to go up with 1 to 2 seconds and lower with about 2 to 3. Okay? So you want to emphasize the eccentric load if you're using a full range, right? So 1, 2, typically do whatever you have to do to get that weight up, and then lower it with about a 2 to 3 second count under control, right? So remember that 5 second per repetition time frame, your speed. Duration. Total number of weeks or months the resistance training is performed. So initial strength gains, we see neurological adaptations very quickly, and they predominate in the first 5 to 8 weeks. Now, it's not a mystery that men and women have different muscle fiber size, right? It's just a fact of life, all right? And a lot of times what we see with strength training programs that are real good, that you see real, real significant gains early on in the weight training program, both in men and women. And that's a neurological adaption. You are teaching your brain and your central nervous system to recruit more fibers from muscle memory and muscle use. All right? But what happens over time, men will continue to go on and make more strength gains where women will plateau off at a quicker rate. It's because of testosterone and because of genetic makeup. Not all women, not all men, but predominantly across the field, you see men continue to make gains because their diameter size has potential to grow because of testosterone influence. Where women, they're plateau. So early on, just remember the changes that you see. You know, you've only been working out for a week and your bench press is going out the roof. That's not because you're getting big, because it takes a longer time for those muscle adaptations to occur. It's because your neurological adaptions, your synapses, your ability to recruit more muscle fibers per activity is kicking in really good. And that you see that very quickly, all right? Muscle hypertrophy, it takes about 6 to 12 weeks of resistive training to see some changes in size. So what's this? This is a schematic of just that. Here's hypertrophy growth, and here's actually neural factors. So early on, you see the neural factors are high in contributing to overall strength. Here's strength. But as time goes by, here's time, and time waits for no one. As time goes by, the neurological factors became less and less, and the hypertrophy or the growth factors become more and more. So you see changes in strength in men more specifically than in women, but typically we're all about the same around that time frame. Static isometric exercises. Static, isometric, okay? Frequency, intensity, time, type. Isometric. We use these to prevent or minimize joint atrophy when joint motion is not possible. We use these to muscle re-educate. We will have folks, after knee surgery, you put a big tourniquet across the knee or above, you know, the surgeon is doing his deal. We can't have a huge blood flow or a blood field during the surgery. So what they do is they put like a compression tourniquet and they let it off. It kind of goes through its processes, but what that does is neurologically shut off the quads oftentimes. So you get a patient, they come to you in rehab, post-op day one, status post anterior cruciate ligament repair, and everything they try to get that quadricep to fire, they can't do it. And because what's happening from their brain to their muscle to their body, it's just been deconditioned from surgery. So we start them with isometric quad sets. Force is being generated, but no movement's occurring in that joint. Really, really effective way to muscle re-educate. If you think of that example during the test, you won't forget what isometric are used for, okay? You can break down that one example and probably get past all your needs, all right? So it's very early in the rehab. There's not a lot of joint motion. We're still maximally protecting these folks. So joint motion's not possible. Oftentimes, we use isometric when dynamic actions are limited by pain. All right. If it really, really hurts to move, but we want that person to maintain their muscle tone and strength, we'll get some isometric strengthening going because it won't hurt them. There's that muscle setting, right? There's that gal. She's got to keep that quad strong. She's pushing that back part of her knee into the tail, and she's re-educating her muscle. That's probably the primary reason why we use isometric exercises. All right. Now, the limitation, it will not really improve strength that much. Isometric strengthening really doesn't improve strength that much. it will maintain the strength at that angle the leg's in, and it will help re-educate. But if I want to improve someone's strength, they don't get sent home with a huge isometric strength training program, right? Okay, multi-angle resisted exercises, submaximal to maximal isometric contractions. Sometimes what we do is it just hurts to move the whole range in the elbow. So we're having them do an isometric contraction here, we're having them do it here, and we're having them do it here. Different ranges, so we can affect as much of that range of motion as possible. Okay? So it can improve static strength at various angles throughout the range of motion. That would be real consistent with that bench press sticking. Remember that bench pressing we were talking about? That guy, that gal, they can only, their sticking point's always here. That's the weakest point. So we can isometrically strengthen them, maybe at that one point, so they can be better able to move a little less weight. All right. So I would really love for you guys to know the frequency that we would perform isometric exercises if we gave them to someone. If we're trying to re-educate the muscle, remember the key to education, learning, is what? Repetition. So we probably want them to do it a lot, up to hourly. We want to get a good 10-second hold per repetition. The type of isometrics, just like it said in the examples, muscle-setting exercises, or you can give resisted isometrics throughout a whole range of motion. These are submaximal effort, progress to maximal effort, typically single angle, and oftentimes you can actually hook electrodes to people's muscles to see if they're actually kicking in. Very effective. But you have to know that we do them multiple times a day, and we'd want you to hold them for at least 10 seconds to work, right? Man, I'm a good guy. Static isometric stabilization exercises. Here's our core strengthening, right? Core strengthening. We reduce instability, we enhance postural joint stability, provide core proximal strength, base for dynamic exercises. Now, this is something I always teach my low back pain patients when I'm trying to get the core strengthening going. Although in the Army, the Navy, Air Force, maybe the Air Force. I love the Air Force. They were very good to me. Coast Guard. We teach our abdominals to be very dynamic things. Now, our abdominal muscles, honestly, they have two functions in life. They expel, they're really important for expiration, and they're stabilizers. Now, we can kind of use them to curl our body, but that's not the main function in life. So in the Army, we train them dynamically, right? But the folks that really know their stuff, like those really high-end bodybuilders, when they train their abs, they train them statically. They're the ones that know how to contract their abs really, really good when they're doing like a tricep pushdown. You know who has sick abs? Really sick abs? Folks in martial arts that have low body mass index. Because in martial arts, you really have to get a good base of support. Anytime that you kind of ready yourself for a motion, the firing sequence is your core first, right? And you know how it is when you have to engage in combatives. You have to steady yourself and get a good base of support or you're going to get thrown around. But because they're used to having those static contractions all the time, they rip up their abs where they have to compromise their safety at the beach. So the abs are really static stabilizers. So when we want to train the abs, do you think clinically we give folks a whole bunch of like crunches? No. What I do is I teach them to do the best static contraction that they can, and then I give them dynamic exercises that make it harder to hold those dynamic contractions, okay? So there's really great value to exercises like flutter kicks. Flutter kicks might not be the best exercise for someone with low back pain, but if you get they force you to have a very, very definitive static abdominal contraction when you do them. So another exercise that you're probably familiar with, when people do bicycles, when they put their elbow to their knees very quick, great stabilizing exercise. Remember that one that you see in the gym where people get on their toes and their elbows, the plank? Believe it or not, if you do really, really good push-ups with a really straight back, you could rip up your abs like nobody's business because you're really calling in on those static stabilizers. They're isometric, static, stabilizing contractions. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. So, that core, it's humongous. It's a base of support for dynamic exercise. So what's happening here for him to move his arms and legs effectively? His core is firing like all get out. All right. So it's not the ability to really move the arm and legs that's important here. It's the ability to maintain that static contraction. And when you fire up your abs, if you do it right, it should happen 360 degrees around where the small muscles of the low back are all jazzed up too. All right. How do we do core stabilization? It doesn't look like it's too important if you ask me. But no, we typically ask folks to do it quite a few times a day. It's a max effort at however good that they can hold their abdominal contraction, however hard. We have them hold it for 10 to 60 seconds. It's a stabilization exercises typically revolve around our core. Okay, core stabilizers. You're going to hear that term a lot. You're going to own that term. And the hold time progression for muscle endurance, at least for 10 seconds, up to 10 seconds or to fatigue, but no longer than 60 seconds. Okay, the best core strengthening program that I give to patients, I have them do one set of 10 for 10 second holds. So, do you have a question? Sure. Pilates, if done right, modified for a low back patient, is very, very effective. Very effective. And Pilates is neat. It really calls in on primarily the abdominal muscles that are like waistband and below. And the thing is, there's a muscle group called the transverse abdominis. If you can fire that, because it's such a weak, weak muscle, if you can fire that, the chances of the rest of your abdominals firing are very good. Now, make no mistake, sports fans, there's only one neurological connection to your abs. When you fire off your obliques versus your rectus abdominis versus your transverse abdominis, it's not like you can turn on one switch and turn off the other, okay? The key is to get a really good definitive contraction that gets them all involved, and that's why Pilates is real good. So, yeah, it's the real deal. Did it help you? Okay. There you go. Please. WIMS flexion exercises are more consistent with spinal flexion to open up the vertebral facets and kind of get more of an opening flexion type thing. Not so much for abdominal strengthening, no. For sure, for sure. All right. This looks like a rough slide here. So there's some concerns. Why wouldn't we want to train some isometric folks? It can actually decrease venous return in some folks. We have the, what's the term that I'm looking for? The Valsalvic maneuver, where people will do a very heavy isometric contraction and not breathe, which can contract on major blood vessels that go to the heart. So you have to be cautious with folks with hypertension or cardiac disease. Isometric exercise can produce increased response in blood pressure, so you may need to minimize the hold time for folks that are in this grouping. It's just not a good idea to hold your breath when you're contracting your muscles. So, now, there's a time and a place for it, for stabilization and stuff, but it wouldn't be good for these folks that their blood pressure could go to an unsafe limit. So how do we do dynamic exercise prescription? Where are we at here? Let's do a slide count. How about that, sports fans? Ooh! We're going to move through here. Let's fight the good fight. How are you guys doing? We got a little form fatigue. We still got a little anger going from the test, retest, retest, test, test. Do we need to take a break right now? We can. You guys are definitively the boss, the jefes. Is there any really good Spanish-speaking folks in the class? Does anybody speak Espanol? Mr. Manigotes? Can you be my Spanish maestro throughout the course? Nice, nice. So, Spanish down here in San Antonio is a very, very vital part of your social skills. It will open doors for you that you can never imagine in a very, very definitive good way. So, dynamic exercise. This is where our bread and butter's at, folks. That's where your concentric and eccentric muscle actions are going to happen. A concentric accelerate body motions where eccentric decelerate. And you would not believe how important these eccentric measures are in life, but we neglect them in the clinic. All right? Exercises chosen to simulate functional activities. They may vary the parameters to address strength, endurance, and or power needs. High speed eccentric exercise and light phases of rehab. Eccentric exercise is rough. You know when you do your squatting in the gym and you're not used to that activity, and the next day you're feeling a little kind of stiff, and that second day out from your workout you can barely walk because you have delayed onset of muscle soreness? If you truly, truly want to get rough, tough, and buff, you really need to learn all about eccentric loading, okay? Because that's where you're going to get your microfailures. That's where you're going to see muscles. If you think about that actin and myosin being together, and you're eccentrically loading those muscles, and that pull, pull, pull to the point of a tear, okay? Now your recovery phase has to do with the adaptations to address those things, where it's a lot harder to get that effect when you're doing just concentric or isometric. So the really high-end bodybuilders or the folks that really want to look great, they know how to really emphasize the eccentric load. That's why, like, you do a pull-up real controlled and you do it real slow on the way down, you know. When you do a bench press, you power up and then you do a controlled return. You might not be able to move as much weight, but you will rip the fibers up like all get out, and then it'll help with, increasing fiber size. So eccentric loading is humongous, humongous in function. Running, jumping, twisting, turning, if you don't have an eccentric component to it, you will fall to the ground, all right? And we neglect that in the clinic. A lot of times we give just concentric emphasized exercises, and then those folks will go out and fail. So anytime I have a tendon or a muscle problem, I always try to work some eccentric loading into that exercise protocol. Does that make good sense to you guys? You don't care. You just want to get to slide 51, 81. So progressive resistive exercise. Please know this term. It will come and haunt you in the clinic setting. Dynamic resistance training with a constant external load. Rehab uses. Yes, we'd like to minimize impairments, and we'd like to improve and maintain physical function. There's a big injury prevention component there, too. So here are some examples of progressive resistive exercise. Look, there's some battlefield expedient training. Don't try that at home, sports fans. There's no reason to. Wow. How do we get the resistance going? We see all of these in the clinic. Resistive bands, body weight, free weights, weight machines, free weights and weight machines. That's kind of consistent with your, what are those machines that we call them? Man, it's blanking me. Not so much Nautilus, that's more of a selectorized system, but that's more, we're seeing them more and more in military gyms. The hammer curl, the hammer strength, you know, like you can push through, you load the plates up, but they're still kind of, they're angulated and have levers. The hammer strength, yeah. A Smith machine is a good example. It definitely has, is that what you're talking about, the Smith machine? You're no stranger to the gym, are you? I can tell. So family member or clinician. Oftentimes, the clinician will provide the external resistance. We do that in PNF techniques, right? Someone will pull across their body and work be their resistance. Very effective. How often do we want to do this, sports fans? If we want to see gains in the gym or the fitness arena or in the clinic, we need to do at least 2 to 3 days a week for each major muscle group or body part. 3 times a week may increase arm and leg strength gains by 20 to 30% when compared to just 2 times a week. So that's one of those things where Mo is better, but not too much Mo, right? 3 times a week may be optimal for beginners, whereas 2 times a week may be optimal for advanced trainers due to higher training volumes. This is humongous. Do you guys want to hear some cool strength training tips? Because I am a certified strength and conditioning specialist. I was a certified athletic trainer before, I still am, and I got to do a rotation with the Texas Rangers, and I worked for the University of Richmond before I came to the Army. I'm not trying to impress you, but I know what I'm talking about. Okay, I'm trying to impress you a little bit. Now, I'll tell you, when it comes to lifting very heavy weights, addressing those major muscle groups, if you really, really want to grow, and some of you bigger guys out there can attest to this, training volume, as far as consistency, as far as frequency, less is more. You need to do bench press very heavy, you need to do squatting very heavy, and you need to do deadlifts very heavy. And if you do those very heavy for growth purposes, you really only need to do them well one time a week. So when we want to get guys really, really big, what we're having to do is bench press, squat, and deadlift very heavy one day a week, not all the same day. And then we may revisit that muscle group individually at a submaximal weight another day throughout the week. But it's only really one heavy day. So one of the best training programs for growth that I see is, and I got this from the University of Notre Dame. Anybody hear of it? It's a pretty cool place, Fighting Irish. They have a strength training program that you will do a big vertical push and a big vertical pull day on Monday. On Tuesday, you will do quad-specific exercises, like leg extensions, maybe some leg presses, maybe some lunges. Wednesday's off. You just take Wednesday off. Thursday now becomes, is it Thursday already? It's Thursday. Is your vertical push-pull day. Okay? And then Friday is your hip-specific. Your deadlifts, your Romanian deadlifts, and maybe you could work some calves in there. And that's it. They don't do any other strength training because people don't realize that your other muscle groups are working very very aggressively to support and help. But they're used that weight training program over 6 to 8 weeks, and it's ridiculous how big you see some of these guys get. And it's so tempting not to hit your chest another day of the week or work your quads another day of the week, but it's a forced rest model. But their volume is very high, their weights are very high, so they need the rest. All right? Just a little... All right. So here's some examples of some exercise programs, some split training programs performed 4 to 5 days a week. Here it's Sunday. Maybe we'll work lower body Monday, upper body Tuesday, rest Wednesday, lower body, upper body, and rest. That's one way of doing it. Here's a 6 day a week split routine. Chest and back, lower body, chest and arms. There's all different ways to do it. I'm not a huge fan of spot-specific training. I think we have a whole body, and our body likes movement patterns. But you can get very good growth from all different ways of doing it. But when it comes to dynamic exercises, you need volume for growth. So 4 times a week, 6 times a week, that sounds like a lot, but you're breaking up body parts and stuff. These are just examples coming from the Essentials of Strength Training and Conditioning, which is the Bible for strength and conditioning specialists. All right, the schematic kind of tells you how many repetitions that you need to do to emphasize different components of resistive training. All right, if I want to get really, really strong, I work within about 3 to 5 reps. If I want to work on muscular endurance, I'm working higher up on the scale. Here's RM zone. Again, strength, these are good things to know. If I want to get a patient strong, I'm going to have them lift as much as they possibly can between 3 to 7 times. So that guy that we're trying to get really thick on that bench press, squatting, and deadlifting, they're lifting very, very heavy weights 3 to 5 times typically. Combined strength and endurance, 8 to 12. And for endurance, you need to do more than 12. All right? Take home message there. All right, volume. You have to pay attention to SINs, their training status. Are they beginners? Are they elite? But typically 1 to 3 sets for beginners and 2 to 3 sets, sometimes possibly 3 to 4 sets after plateau has reached in strength gains. Higher training volumes promote further strength gains. The more volume, the more increase in muscle size we see. But always, always limited by form fatigue, right? Ever see those guys bench pressing where their tailbones and their buttocks comes off the bench? Or ever see those guys that can lift a whole bunch of weight, but they bring the weight to here? They're like bench pressing. They're like, what is that? It's form fatigue. So, full range of motion, right? Full safe range of motion with a weight that you could keep very, very good posture that's not unsafe for your body. Perfect practice makes perfect performance. I will tell you, it's worked for me incredibly well, but if you do 30 perfect push-ups, right, Mr. Zimmer? Right, Ms. McDonald? If you do 30 perfect push-ups, rest a minute, do 25 perfect push-ups, rest a minute, do 20, give yourself a minute, do 15, rest a minute, and do 10. It will smoke you like crazy, and it'll have definitive benefit for your, and I didn't say it before, but your rabbit push-ups that you're going to do during the PT test, okay? So perfect practice makes perfect performance. All right. Dynamic exercise intensity weight progression. Increase load about 5 to 10% when one can perform current load beyond repetition range. And this is typically what we see. You're trying to do it about 8 to 12 times. Now you're doing a 13, 14. You can typically increase your weight by about 5 to 10%. We see this very readily with the dumbbells. It's like, okay, I'm doing chest presses with 50s, and now I'm beyond my 8 to 12 repetition max. So what do? I don't jump up to the 75 sports fans. I go to the 55s, right? The double nickels, right? So this is just, you guys that have spent time in the gym, 5 to 10% increase, right? You see a couple, you know, digits in your RM max, we increase 5 to 10%. Single to multiple set progression. Yeah, I see this. So this is the folks that keep the weights consistent, but their transition with their progression, where maybe week one and two, you were just doing one set of everything. Maybe weeks two through three, you were doing two sets of everything, and then you can move up to 3 to 5 sets, right? It's good. Patients begin with a weight that allows the performance of multiple sets. I would say if you're doing more than 3 sets of 10 repetitions, that the weight's either too light or you're not hitting really overload, you know. You're using that same 50-pound dumbbell. You're hitting 10 times real easy, 3 sets every time. Your strength gains are going to be minimal. You need to increase either your decrease the amount, increase the weight, basically, or increase the number of sets that you're doing. Speed, lifting velocity, slow to moderate for strength and hypertrophy gains. So if you really want to get rough, tough, and buff, you do a 2-centric concentric and a 2-to-4-centric eccentric. Faster movement is for power development. That's why the Pete Sampras's of the world, he can generate a lot of power, but he doesn't get big and thick because he's more power-oriented and fast motions, right? But if you're going to want to get real big, tough, and buff, you're not the guy that's doing the rabbit push-ups, the really quick. And you can get big that way if you go to ultimate fatigue, but if you're doing 3 sets of 10, it's much, much better to do slow, controlled movement with lighter weight for that micro ripping and micro failure, right? So, all right, let's finish it up. 75 out of 81, right? So duration and time. General exercise. Sufficient to perform at least 1 to 8. You know, this is an interesting component. For general exercise, for the general population, not for our elite athletes, but for folks that just need to make strength gains, if they do an exercise correctly, at the right speed that we just said, do it well, where they truly get fatigue, where they have true fatigue without form fatigue, they will make benefit. They will make changes. They will have changes. They will increase in strength. All right? It's hard to believe. Sufficient time clinically. Clinically, oftentimes, if we teach the patient right, they will get a benefit out of just one set. Your training volume and your form fatigue will dictate how much time and how long you work these people out, all right? I don't like to harp on the point too much, but how you exercise folks and how you're going to give them their training volume and their duration, it really is dictated based on the patient's goals and what you're trying to get them back to. But if you give them good exercise education, and you see in the clinic that they're doing these exercises picture perfect without form fatigue, and you're giving them the right intensity with the right volume, then they're going to benefit from just doing those 1 to 2 sets, okay? That's important to know. Now, order of exercise determination. It's a good idea to do those larger muscle groups first. Does anybody have an idea why? Why do we do the big muscle groups first? Please.
Because when you do the larger muscle groups, you also do the smaller muscle groups.
Yes. Did everybody hear that? When you're doing the larger muscle groups, and let's break it down with the big pushes, the big pulls, and the big presses, okay? Now, I'm doing a big, big push, right? I'm doing a big push. Multiple muscles involved. Chest muscles, shoulder muscles, triceps are really blasting out. So the smaller group muscles are those kind of accessory motion muscle groups, the smaller muscles. Now, they're getting real tired, right? And they're really an important part of doing those big pushes, right? Same thing, when I'm doing big pulls, I'm getting big back muscles, and I'm also getting posterior deltoid and biceps, right? Now, we really want to make our biceps really, really tired before we do those big pulls, because now those big pulls are going to be limited by what the biceps can or can't do. Does that make sense? So, it's just, to me, that is kind of like, it's not rocket science. If I know Sergeant Airborne's going to make me do a whole bunch of chin-ups, right? And I need to do 10 chin-ups before I even get on his training site, I'm not going to max out with a whole bunch of bicep curls in my room so I have big... I won't go be doing, like, curlies for the girlies, right? Is that what they say? So you don't rep out and tire out your smaller muscle groups before you do the bigger muscle areas. And that's important. And there's a time and a place for that. So single joint or smaller muscle groups typically go last. Higher intensity before lower intensity. Why do we do that? Why do we do higher intensity activities before lower intensity? Well, you can definitely warm up with the lower intensity exercises, kind of sub-maximal exercise, but typically, I'm sorry?
Is it your energy level?
Yes, fatigue for sure, because there's definitely a place for higher intensity activity, right? When you're doing that higher intensity exercising, you want really good form so you don't have form fatigue. So why would you tire yourself out on the lower intensity exercises before you go into those higher intensity things, you know? I do this all the time. This is the way I typically train people, because most adults, their biggest enemy with working out is time, right? So they need a very efficient workout program. So as far as keeping the body moving and keeping the heart rate up, I'm a big fan of like circuit training if done right. But alternating between upper and lower body exercises can fight fatigue. And opposing muscle groups, you can go through very definitively in the gym. And yes, I will correct any misconceptions, but this is a body by Jimmy Broad. Okay? This is built by Jimmy. Okay? This is a body by Jimmy. And I will move through because I know I only have so much time. But you can combat with little to no rest in between your workout program if you start with a big push and you turn out with a big pull, or you can alternate between lower and body exercises, right? Does that make good sense? Okay, fit considerations for dynamic exercise. If you want to increase your body's ability to do dynamic exercises, we know we need to do it at least 2 to 3 times a week, right? Your intensity is based on your tissue healing, your rehab, but most importantly, your goal, right? If we want to get someone really strong, we're going to give them 3 to 7 reps, right? If we want to increase their endurance, we've got to go past 12. Is this all making sense real good to everybody? Your time, that's not going to change too much for folks, all right? Your time is going to be consistent with what you're trying to do, and most folks go in the gym to get strong, right? So we probably want to see them move within about a 5-second repetition with a heavy emphasis on that eccentric phase. If we really want to make them powerful, we're probably going to decrease that contraction time because they need to be able to do it fast, right? And then you're going to learn next lecture, and this next lecture killed everybody on the last exam. So we're going to fight the form fatigue like nobody's business. We're going to go take a 10-minute break, I believe. But the type is going to be, you know, open versus closed kinetic chain. Isokinetic is more of a rehab type thing that we do. But the type of dynamic exercise you're going to see is a new term, open or kinetic chain, that we really, really have to fight the good fight on, because for some reason, this killed everybody. Maybe we should have taught this first, don't you think? Where you guys were fresh, before you got the news of the test, retest, test, test. Okay. Typical progression. We do single sets, and we move to more sets. All right? Multiple sets with the given resistance, and then we add the resistance. So it's probably better, if you're taking that beginner, you get them a good, safe 10 RM, right? You get that 10 RM going. We want one set, right? Go see how you're doing with that one set of 10 repetitions. They come back, hey, doc, I'm feeling great. I can do more. Okay, now we're going to keep the same weight. We're going to go to 2, maybe 3 sets. They come back, you got to give me more. Now we're going to maybe increase the weight and then go back to maybe that 1 to 2 sets. But we don't want to increase both the sets and the weights at the same time, because then we won't know where the miscue is at, right? So you kind of change and increase your progression to where you can control it and know where you go from there. Does that make sense? So increase your number of sets up to 3, and then increase your weights, right? All right, I'm praying that there's not another slide. Okay.